In that St. Patrick's Parade thing, what kind of sounds were they playing? What was going on? What was the music?
They were playing New Orleans R&B.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Like what?
Like Fats Domino. Like the leader of the player, the leader of the band was a piano player. He had an electric piano up there, and he was doing a lot of Fats Domino and who's the other one? Oh, Clarence Frogman Henry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when you moved here at that point, so did you manage? Were you suddenly managing to pick up work? I mean, was this
the day I got off the bus? It was dawn, mm-hmm. and I had no money. I had phone numbers of people who I didn't know. Susan gave me some numbers. If you call this one, call that one. I knew from coming down here for that week, I knew where Jackson Square was. Mm. And if I could get myself to Jackson Square, I could hustle enough money to, you know, to eat and mm-hmm. Maybe find a place to sleep that night. So I had a duffel bag and I had, the soprano with me. I had my tenor, I had a flute, and I walked to Jackson Square from the bus station, and waited till there was people out there, mm-hmm. and then I opened up the soprano case and I started to play, and within 45 minutes of being out there, this guy walked by me. His name is Charles Butler, and he walked by. He walked up to me and stopped and stood there listening. And he said, "Well, you really play pretty good." He says, "Did you just get to town?" It was pretty obvious because I had the duffel bag and I had basically all my possessions that I took from Boston with me. And I said, "Yeah, I just got here." He said, "Yeah, I've never seen you before." He says, "Look, I have a band and we need a sax player." And he says, "And I have an apartment with an extra bedroom." Says, "Why don't you come with me?"
Well,
so within an hour after opening up that case, mm-hmm. I had a place to live and employment.
Great story. And what was Mr. Butler's band?
I don't remember the name or anything, but it was a band that played sort of jazz kind of stuff. And uh-huh. It was a poet, so it was poetry reading and uh-huh. yeah, that kind of
well,
thing.
You know, since I knew you when I met you, which is already 22 years ago or some 20 years ago, you were a tenor player. You were just playing tenor,
yeah.
And then, so at what point did it switch from you are a soprano player as your identity to you're mostly playing tenor all the time? And this is what you're related to. Because by the time I met you, it was hard to get you to put your hands on a soprano.
Yeah, it's been like that ever since. And I've got a lot of sopranos at my house, and it's still hard to bring them out. It was a matter of necessity. My first real professional band in town was with Walter Washington. And I just played a soprano with Walter, which most people find so hard to even put that together with the way Walter plays and sings and the way the band sounds, and then having this light horn on top of it. But that's what I did. I played exclusively soprano with Walter. And I was with him for a year and a half. Got the gig, a few weeks after I got to town.
So it was like 78, 79.
This was in 78. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was with him. We were playing with, we were playing for Johnny Adams. We were doing
that's
his show. Close.
Yeah.
Then I don't remember how I got the call for Irma Thomas, but I got the call. Uh-huh. And she was obviously one of the most successful vocalists in town, and she had a successful band. And in that band, I had to play tenor. And there was no way of getting around it. Uh-huh. I had to be a tenor player in that band, so I had to force myself to put down my love and just stick with the tenor. Mm-hmm. So I did it. I guess I did it pretty okay because I tried to quit the band once after I'd been in it for a couple of years, and she begged me to stay. She said that I was getting a reputation, and if I went somewhere else, it wouldn't be the same. She also told me I could play as much as I wanted, as long as I wanted, and you know, there was no restrictions on me. So I was developing a tenor to a certain degree, but I wasn't really happy about it. I wasn't convinced. I still wanted to play the soprano. Mm. So what happened was, when I left Irma's band, it was the end of 1982. Mm-hmm. I decided to go for 6 months without playing in public. Mm-hmm. I was going to just focus on really working on a tenor. I mean, I wouldn't touch the soprano. Mm-hmm. And just worked really hard on my tone, worked hard on my dexterity, worked hard on development of ideas, and did not play one gig in public. Mm-hmm. And that made a big difference. Mm-hmm. I was restoring pianos by this time, and I had a very good job, and I had a lot of flexibility. And so I was able to really put a lot of time on.
You were working a job at the same time?
Yeah,
at
that point. Yeah, I was working restoring pianos. Mm-hmm. And I made a lot of progress. Those 6 months made a big difference in my playing. So when I decided I wanted to play again, I just sat in a couple places, and people were like, oh, yeah, come on. And what was fortunate about that period was that's the period where was the beginning of really my career in New Orleans as a sax player. Those other two things I had done, I couldn't say they were, you know, the development of the career that I have now. Mm-hmm. It happened in that 6 months that I spent just studying and then playing with bands that were not doing the cover tunes. The bands that I started to play with in 83 on were bands that were playing their own music.
What were those bands?
One was called Gulfstream. I started playing with David Goodman, who we ended up forming a stick band. He played a Chapman stick. Both very original music bands. Mm-hmm. And you know, what you could call jazz fusion or whatever. There was another band called the New Jazz Quintet. It's an electric band. A couple of guitars, keyboards, but they brought me in. It was all original. So it was like all these original bands that were bringing me in to play with them. And I was very happy because then the stuff that I had developed really fit the styles of those bands. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'd gone back to another R&B band, I'd be considered overplaying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you really had a drive to be doing something. There was clearly something on your mind already at this point, though.
Yeah, I realized that I really needed to develop a tenor, and I needed to go to the next level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what did you feel was driving that? Does this have something to do with? I mean, you know, I'm interested at somewhat now about, like, well, there's three things really that I'd like to talk about that are sort of about. Sort of follow up to what you said before. One is, how were you finding what you were doing in relation to all the musicians that you'd met in New York, and also your fundamental, like, drive for music, which is clearly something, this fascination starts early on, and so now you're really coming into your own a little bit more, and I'm wondering whether there's a way that, you know, where the drive for the decision and the clarity to do something's coming from at this point.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that question because it was, mm-hmm, just there. It was just natural, mm-hmm, to want to play. And then once I was able to do it, the more I played, the more I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. You know, I would just call it an obsession or a calling, I don't know, but mm-hmm, it was very, very dominated my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so Gulfstream, the stick band, and you were probably also working other...
Yeah, there were other little groups. I can't remember all the names of them, but mm-hmm, yeah, there was a lot of little things going on in this period of a few years. That I wanted to do, and like I said, it was all, I wasn't making a living at it. I wasn't trying to at that time, but I was playing with bands that were interesting to me, that were original. It meant, at a certain point, me understanding that I wasn't on the same path, musical path or journey that most guys take. If they're saxophone player, you go study with a couple of teachers and they teach you all the bebop licks and you learn a bunch of standards and you do that. And I did that at Berkeley to some extent because there were those ensemble rooms you could sign out and you could get bands together, a couple guys together and say, hey, let's go have a jam. But that wasn't as interesting to me as playing original music. Mm-hmm. And I was just lucky enough to find groups that wanted to do that. In that period of time, at one point, Kalamu Ya Salaam was trying to get me hooked up with Ellis Marsalis. At some point, Ellis didn't have a horn player. And Kalamu thought I was good enough. I wasn't sure whether I was good enough, but what I knew for sure was I didn't know the tunes. Uh-huh. And I told Kalamu, I said, look, I don't know all those songs. I mean, I'm going to be stumbling and fumbling around trying to play with him because I don't know the music. He says, well, you're a good sax player. I says, yeah, but you got to know the tunes. So I don't know whether I declined a good opportunity for myself or not. I don't spend time thinking about it. But he was very... Kalamu was very certain that I could do the gig. Mm-hmm. And I was very certain I couldn't without knowing the music.
Wow.
And I didn't need to know... What I needed to know with the other bands that I was playing with is they would teach me the composition, whatever it was. And I was interested in it. I was interested in an original thought.
Mm-hmm. Were you touring?
No, not at all.
Okay, not even with Irma, none of that.
No, Irma never moved during that time. She had a very good career, made a very good living right here in the New Orleans metropolitan area. And Walter certainly didn't travel.
Let's talk about this a little bit. So now, what was the relationship between audiences and music at that time? And I'm trying to work out culturally what was going on in response to this. And it's like you said, you were playing some kind of jazz fusion, or there's R&B, and blah, blah, blah. In New Orleans is at this point... This is before it's made the decision to be absolute. I mean, I'm sure I had a lot of tourists, but I hadn't made the decision to go with tourist economy yet, I think, politically. So what was going on internally? What was it like playing back then?
All I could tell you from my perspective was that there were people interested in what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We played enough to have a band, to keep a band together, to rehearse. I can't really tell you what the overall scene was like then. I didn't know because I had not much time for that. I was restoring pianos and practicing and rehearsing with these groups. Mm-hmm. And these groups were not, they weren't, actually we did play in Snug Harbor. So we were able to get into some of the establishment, but that's not, wasn't our main goal. We just wanted to play. Mm-hmm. We'd play wherever anyone would let us. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a real answer for that. The way I know how things were working in the 90s, I didn't know in the 80s. Wasn't on my radar.
How does it look different to what things are like now? In your memory.
It appears to me now that there's a great deal of acceptance for artists to come out and do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And that there'll be an audience for it somewhere in town. I think this could be accurate to say that it seems more easy to put out or present what it is you do now than it was back then. There were a lot more commercial things going on in town. Not that there aren't now, but if you're strictly a jazz musician, you're doing a lot of playing on Bourbon Street, mm-hmm. and Tyler's, and, well, it used to be called Fallberg, and then it eventually became Snug Harbor. You had just a few venues to play. If you play alternative types of music.
What was an alternative type of music?
Well, like the bands I was playing with.
Okay. Gotcha.
I mean, the stick band was a trio with the lead player playing a Chapman stick. Just was not... Everybody, every time we play it, what is that in? What are they doing? And that sort of thing. Gulfstream was had traditional instrumentation, but everything we played was, there was not one cover tune of any sort in that band. We had a huge repertoire. And we managed to get into Snow Harbor a couple times, and the stick band got in there semi-regularly. But there seems to be more places to play now that if you're interested in not playing New Orleans music, whatever that's supposed to be, that you can have a place to play at least occasionally.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a curious thing though, but for some reason, you know, just as also being a musician here in a shorter time, it's the last 22 years or so, that it feels to me like there were more places to play back then, but I guess there wasn't. But it just seemed like, for some reason, when I got here, psychologically for me, it seems like there was more places to play. But I guess now, maybe it's inaccurate. Maybe I was just up in more diverse places. It's funny how the memory works. But what, let me see here. The other thing I want to ask. So then you restore cars and you restore pianos and you do very fine jobs in this too. Is there some way that you feel there's a relationship in the way that your mind works between dealing with those things and dealing with playing the horn and your approach to that? I'll let you go if you need to go.
No, I'm good. I don't have to be uptown another hour. I guess the best way to answer that is to say that I learned early in life that the only thing keeping me down really is myself. Mm-hmm. Like if there's something I'm interested in, I need to go after it. Mm-hmm. And restoration of cars and pianos and furniture and that sort of thing, that's stuff that I was interested in early as a kid. And I was good with my hands. And I just did it. I never really thought much about it other than, okay, want to do this, go get the instrument or go get a piece of furniture and fix it up. And and when I was in high school, I was building furniture. So I liked taking a couple pieces of wood, just, you know, planks, and creating something out of it that, you know, that came formed from my mind, and then my hands accomplishing it, what my mind told it to do. There is, I think, some kind of connection between that and music and just the whole creative aspect, especially when you look at a piece of wood, like I said, or rusty piece of metal and think you're going to do something with it. Same with music for me. I try to come to music every time I play with a blank slate. I try real hard, even on my regular gig that I have now. I try to approach every solo as if this is the first time I'm playing it. And that's what helps keep the creative juices flowing for me, is to try to approach everything as it's, you know, first time.